uyakwazi ukuthumela ama-email na.
We translate for those who can't understand. We write for those who can't hear. We describe for those who can't see. SubT, subtitles and accessibility for film, television and theater. SubT.com. Fred.
This is Christiana Palmieri for Fred Film Radio from the Sydney Film Festival.
My name is Roberto Pombo, here on Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Io sono Laura Buffa e questa è una nuova puntata di Fred Mag.
Mein Name ist Beatrice Bieden und ich spreche mit Andreas Puczaska.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Cinephile, you're listening to the Big Fred Tuesday, Fred Film Radio's weekly show on all things cinema, with a particular focus on independent filmmaking and the international film festival scene. The show is hosted and produced by yours truly, Matt Micucci, and I have to begin with a disclaimer of sorts. This show has to be pre-recorded, so at the time that you'll hear it, you'll probably already know who the winners of this year's Oscars are. So the good news is that you don't actually have to hear it from me. The other good news, of course, is that cinema exists well beyond the bounds of the Academy Awards, and that there is a whole slew of films waiting to be discovered every year and that don't even get considered for one of those glamorously clad golden statuettes. But anyways, this is online radio's only weekly show on all things cinema that I know of, and each week I bring you conversations with filmmakers, actors, artists and preeminent figures of the film industry. This week will be no different. We'll be focusing in on a new film called Sombra, which was presented at the BCN Film Festival in Barcelona, Spain, and talks about trauma, grief, child kidnapping and human trafficking. We'll be speaking about it with both its director Bruno Gascón and its lead actor Ana Moreira. After that, we'll be speaking with Guido Hendricks about his new provocative documentary, A Man and a Camera, the premise of which is simple yet incredibly original. This is Guido's second appearance on Fred Film Radio, as I had already met him at the One World International Human Rights Film Festival in Prague in 2018, I believe, where he presented his documentary Stranger in Paradise. This new work, A Man and a Camera, is premiering in the main competition of CPH Docs in Copenhagen. Stick around for that one, as well as our recurring popcorn classic and dictionary of film segments. If you like movies and you'd like to further your explorations in the wonderful world of the cinematic art form, you've come to the right place. Fire up an audio teeny, sit back, relax, and listen to the audio waves as they fly through the air.
Fred.
Joining me at this time on the Big Fred Tuesday is Portuguese filmmaker Bruno Gascón. His latest film, Sombra, starring actress Ana Moreira and dealing with very difficult themes and issues, is having its world premiere at the BCN Film Festival, the annual film festival of Barcelona. Bruno, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for inviting me to this show.
I'm very well. Yeah, this is an honor for me. I watched your latest film, Sombra. We're going to be talking about it. Very powerful. But I was wondering, as the director of the film, would you be able to say a few words of introduction to its story for the listeners who are not familiar with it? And then, of course, we will get into it in more detail throughout the course of our interview.
Okay. Sombra is a story about a mother searching for her missing kid through more than 20 years, actually. This is a story about courage, strength, and resilience of this mother. It's all a sort of a love letter from the mother to her son, actually.
I should say that you also wrote as well as directed Sombra. So the natural question is, was there a specific event that served as the genesis for this project and that particularly inspired you?
Yeah, I talked to a lot of families which have missing kids here in Portugal. And there's one specifically mother which helped me a lot to the script. I had already had a script before, but after talking to the families, I changed a bit, and yeah, there was one particular family and mother which helped me a lot on the script.
So there was a fair amount of good research done that you did in such things that are dealt with in the film, like human trafficking, child kidnappings, and so on, while preparing this film.
Human trafficking I did on my first feature film, actually. It was about human trafficking. On the second one, it was more about what happens to the family, what kind of feelings that you have, what happens to the family after the missing kid. It's not more, it's It's not specifically about human trafficking. It's more specifically about the family, the people that stays.
Very interesting, because I was going to ask you about this. I read in your director's notes that you are attracted to stories that lend themselves to a philosophical exploration of the human condition. And I was wondering what you meant by that.
I actually love on my films to talk about social issues and problems, because I think society needs to grow up. And if you close your eyes to these kind of issues, these kind of problems, we never grow up as it is, as a society. So I always try to put my characters in these extreme conditions to see how human work on those conditions, actually. So my idea is to show people that are watching the film, what if I'm in these people's shoes? What did I do if I was on that situation or on this situation? You know, my idea I have a lot of psychological paths on my films and on my characters to create the more real as possible.
So obviously, you feel that cinema can help with these social issues.
Yeah, I think cinema needs to help this kind of issues, you know, because art needs to educate people on it. As it's fiction, of course, but I think it has a big part to help instruct people and educate people and to show how society can work for a better world.
In terms of what you explore in the film, do you see this as being one addressing specifically Portugal and the Portuguese situation, or do you find it has a universal resonance?
I think it has a universal, because I always want to create films that anyone in the world can see and can connect with them. This is a Portuguese story, of course. It's talked in Portuguese and in English, a few parts. But I always try to create stories that anyone in the world can see.
As a filmmaker, do you try to personally find ways to connect with the protagonists of your film psychologically, on a psychological level? And how did you do that in this film, if you do?
Yeah, I think it's one of my strengths. It's working with actors, because I always try to talk to them. We had a lot of meetings and tried to create those layers in those characters. And what I do usually, like, I have this on my script, I have this character, and I start building layers with the actors to put them more psychological layers, to make them look real and create with each other. For example, in Sombra with Ana, before I gave her the script, we had a lot of talks before, and I told her what was the situation, what is this character, in what environment this character works. So I do a specific work with all the actors to put them psychologically and physically on that atmosphere.
It's interesting. I will be interviewing Ana Moreira, actually, for this show at a later point. But while we're on the topic, how did your collaboration together start? When did you first meet? What do you like about her acting styles and her acting talents?
I've seen Anna's work before, and I thought she was the best for this role, because I think she fits very well, this character. And the first conversations I had with her was to prepare her for this huge, powerful drama. And I bring her to the families of missing kids to show her what it's like to be on the shoes of those families. Ana Moreira actually met a few families before the script. So what we did was, with that kind of work, we start building up this huge character, this mother, which is always, she never quits trying to find her son, actually.
We'll be right back with Bruno Gascon to talk more about his latest film, Sombra, in a moment.
Fred.
We're back on the Big Fred Tuesday, and I have been speaking with Portuguese filmmaker Bruno Gascon, director of Sombra, from this year's BCN Film Festival in Barcelona. So, Bruno, I feel that grief is a very central theme of your latest work. Helplessness is another. But just in terms of its title, which translates to English as shadow, what does it mean and what is its significance in the context of your film?
Okay, the title Shadow. It's because she's the light of the film, and she always tries to run in shadows. So the main character, she dresses in yellow because of it. Also, if you can see on the film, she has all these tons of layers in yellow that help her become the light. So she moves between shadows. She's always tries to run away from shadows. And you were talking about the grief, actually. So all the people in the film, all the family, all the people, they all pass through all the stages of grief. Okay? And the main character, there's one stage of grief that she never passes, which is acceptance. She never accepts that her kid will not return. And that's the only stage that she never passes through. All the rest of the people, all the family, all the friends, all the people inside that environment, they all pass the stage of grief and they accept that the kid will not return anymore. But she always tries to find the light through the shadows. That's why the film is called Shadow.
Did you, in representing this grief, did you always have an idea of the style that the film should carry?
Yeah, I always have that style. I made like a lot of work before, all the pre-production. I've made all the shots that you see, all the light that you see, all the set designs, all the wardrobe were properly made for it, to create this perfect world, this perfect family, which just one thing that happens, the missing kid, can destroy a perfect world. And my idea was that, to create this perfect environment where they all live, like this is a family which has money, which has two kids who are very happy, and by a circumstances of life, by one circumstance of life, everything falls off.
So in Sombra, we see the mother, who is the protagonist of the film, as we have mentioned, get little to no support or help in finding her son or finding justice for her son. And that kind of brings me to ask you, are you skeptical of the authorities?
No, I'm not skeptical of the authorities. But what I've read through all the cases of missing kids in Portugal during the 90s, there was a problem because Portugal is a very quiet place and they weren't prepared for this kind of problem. And the police weren't prepared for missing kids in Portugal. They were like, they didn't have any knowledge, anything that could lead them to that, because Portugal, like I was saying, is a really quiet place. And when something like this happens, the police weren't prepared for it.
So do you feel that things have kind of improved since the 90s?
Yeah, a bit. It still has a lot of work to do. Because, for example, in the United States, you have Amber Alert, which is mainly because of a missing girl. So they start to do this kind of app where when someone is missing, when some kid is missing, everyone receives a message about... Everyone receives a message about this girl, about the hair, what kind of hair, what kind of face, what she was dressing. For example, in Portugal, we don't have that. And that's something we can improve, for example. Because from what I've read, the first 24 hours are really important for a missing kid. And still, until today, we are better on it, but they have a lot of work to do. They have a lot to improve for this kind of stuff doesn't happen.
And finally, correct me if I'm wrong, I've been told that you are currently working on your new feature.
Yeah, I'm working on it now, actually.
I won't ask you to reveal too much about that. I don't know the level at which you want to keep things secret and quiet, but I want to ask you just quite simply, because these times have been quite challenging within the film industry. Have you found them challenging also with the pandemic situation?
Yeah, it was kind of hard. We have to adapt a lot. We are living inside of a bubble. We don't have any contact with people from outside. Like, we're all in the same place. No one is here but us. So it's always hard to try to be creative in these sort of times, actually.
Yeah, but you're finding ways to carry on.
Yeah. We're trying to find ways to carry on, of course. We have to.
Yeah, right. Okay, Bruno, thank you very much for joining us. It's been a pleasure speaking with you about your new film, Sombra.
Okay, thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me.
Fred Film Radio.
At the time that you will hear this radio show, Nomadland may or may not have been one of the big winners of this year's Oscars. It's well worth looking at Chiara Nicoletti's recent interview with Bob Wells and Swanky, actors in Chloe Zhao's film, but also people who live the type of nomadic life portrayed in the movie. Take a listen.
First of all, I have to say that I read that at first you didn't want to be part of the film, even though a lot of your stories are included in Jessica Bruder's book, from which the film is based on. So why did you finally decide to be a part of it? It's in such an essential role, I would say.
I didn't understand what the movie was about. I mean, I knew it was based on Jess's book, but I didn't really comprehend the whole thing. I had a lot on my mind. I was trying to arrange. My shoulder was bad. I couldn't lift my arm that high. I couldn't even get it up there. And I load my kayak on top of my van, so I couldn't load my kayak anymore. And that was making me a little crazy because I can't give up kayaking. And Chloe is very tenacious. She knew what she wanted. She and Francis, they already had their mind made up that, you know, they needed me in the movie, but I didn't know that. I didn't understand what the movie was about. I was preoccupied with the pain in my shoulder and the necessity to get it fixed. And I was trying to make arrangements to do all that. And I explained to Chloe that my shoulder was my priority. I had to fix it. And I didn't know if I was going to be in a sling, you know, by the time they were ready to film or what, because I didn't have a surgery date yet. I didn't have a surgeon. I didn't know where I would go to recover or where I would park my rig or anything, you know. So I had a lot to figure out. And she just said, whatever it is, we'll work with it. We'll work around you. And so that's why I'm in a sling in the movie. I was still recovering from surgery.
The film has won a lot and is going straight to the Oscars. And during this film journey, did you feel that the perception of people through your way of life has changed? I mean, do you think that people have become more fascinated, respectful, and maybe less critical towards your choices in life if you experience criticism, of course?
I don't know. A lot of people have a preconceived notion that we're dirty, that we live in a filthy environment, that we're bums or drunks or drug users or something. I don't do any of that. My house is clean. No critters live in here but me. You know, there's nothing crawling around in here. There's no garbage. There's no filth. I don't use drugs. I don't smoke. And so many of the people that I know out here, that's true. They're educated people. They're refined. They're just choosing to live outdoors full time. And so many people have the preconceived notion that that's not true, that we're the people that are actually sleeping on the sidewalks. We don't take showers and we have some kind of social dysfunction or medical problem or something. And it's just not really true. So I think the movie kind of shows who the average people are that are out here, who the typical people are. But it doesn't show a lot of the joy that we get out of this lifestyle about being outside and being in nature all the time. And so I hope it doesn't sensationalize or encourage more people to come out here, because it took me maybe 10 years to prepare to come out here. It's not something you can't just jump in your van and go. You know, you need power. You need sanitation. You got a lot to figure out and learn. And some people just think they can get in the van and go, and then they end up in trouble by doing so. And they're not prepared and they don't succeed at it. So I hope that they don't flee and and come out here to enjoy nature, because it may not work.
The film is very touching, I have to say, and a lot of very emotional moments are related to you and your character in the film. So I was acting a part while being also yourself in a way.
The only part in the movie where I was acting and where I was pretending to be helpless, sick, and dying. I'm not helpless, sick, or dying, or dead. So that part was hard to do, not only because it's not true, but because my ex-husband and the father of my children had died of brain cancer. And I was going to be hard to say that I had that too. You know, it was extremely hard and emotional.
I love the film and I love you, Swanky. So thank you so much for this interview and for
thank
the film.
You. Thank you.
So I have to say that I read Chloe Zhao, director's notes, and she says at one point that it's not possible to fully describe the American road to another person. You have to discover it by yourself. So how would you describe it? And what does this road mean to you?
I would say it's healing. I think above everything else, the American road is healing. It's finding a reconnection with nature, because nature is the main part of the American road. And it's also a reconnection with yourself. It's a time to be alone in your own head, with your own thoughts, in your own heart, with your own feelings. So you can reconnect to nature and to your own self. And it's a time to reconnect with other people. The barriers fall down on the American road. You become a part of instead of an observer of or an enemy of. There is a reconnection that can only be experienced and not really described.
To listen to the full interview, check out fred.fm/UK. That's fred.fm/UK.
Fred Film Radio.
Having spoken with director Bruno Gascón, we now speak with Ana Moreira, who plays the lead role in the film Sombra, which was again screened at the BCN Film Festival in Barcelona in Spain. Ana, welcome to the show.
Hello, Matt. Thank you for having me.
So it's a pleasure. And we're going to be talking about Sombra, the film where you played the lead role. And that's the role of the mother whose child disappears. And the film is a powerful exploration of grief. And we'll be talking about it all in more detail as we continue. But just to kind of start off, I'd like to know about the genesis of this project for you, and just simply ask you, do you remember what your first response to the screenplay was when you read it?
Well, first of all, it took about more or less 2, 3, or 5 meetings with the director Bruno, where he talked to me about the movie and the character. Very slowly, I think, because he didn't want me to be scared of the journey I would have to do to make this character before he gave me the actual script to read. So we had a few informal meetings where he talked about his ideas, where did his will to do this script, to tell this story came from. About the families who have lost their children who were disappeared, about these cases. And then finally he gave me the script and I was amazed because it was a really strong script right there on the paper. And it was a bit scary, but at the same time, it was a challenge. So I had no doubt that it was like a gift for any actor to play such a role. So I was really, really happy to do this movie.
Was there anything that you could initially connect with as far as your character was concerned?
Well, I think more or less everybody can understand losing someone somewhere in their life, either by just, you know, life by losing, I don't know, family member, or just stopped speaking with someone that disappears, that goes away, a friend, maybe a boyfriend or a girlfriend. So that kind of stuff of losing someone that's not there in your life anymore, and the hurt that comes with it, you can identify with that. It's not the same thing, obviously, as losing a child or having a child missing and not having a conclusion where he is. But it's something that you can relate.
Yeah, exactly. But is it difficult to sort of inhabit that space of grief for the length of time during which you were working on this film? Because it's several days in which you have to inhabit this psychological space.
Yes, it's difficult. It's not a happy place to be.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have to do your research, and we did that. We talked with some families, especially the mothers, who have similar cases. And to know a little bit about the emotional place where they are, the emotional journey they've been through. And as an actor, you have to use your intelligence. You have to use your imagination. You have to use your own emotions, and you have to work alongside with the director and with your fellow actors to build the character. So, it was a long journey, but I felt very safe with the director, with Bruno, that he knows very well what he wants, and he's really protective of his actors. So I felt very, very cherished at the same time. So,
yeah, I did speak with Bruno, actually, and he said that it was a very active collaboration, and that you guys really, the two of you really worked together to bring this character to mm-hmm. life.
I mean, during the shooting, it was, and with the crew and the other actors, it was a happy shooting. But the movie is not that happy. But I mean, at the same time, it's a story about love and about hope, and it has some light into it. So
it's
not only about suffering and pain.
Yeah. This is interesting, because we talked earlier about how you kind of try to draw something from previous experiences of loss, not the exact same ones as the character that you portray in the film goes through, but similar situations. But I was also thinking about your filmography a little bit, and I was thinking whether on a psychological level it helped you to work and play the lead role in a film like Trance, from 2006, where you played the role of a woman who actually gets kidnapped and sold into sexual slavery. Because it almost seems to me that in this film, you got to be on the opposite side of a similarly terrible situation.
Yes. Well, they are two different characters, very different. It's and very distant in time. One was in 2006, and this is now. I didn't go, it's really far away from me right now, Trance, so I didn't go there, really. So I have the tendency to play some difficult roles, but it's the directors who write it, not me, so. but no, Trance was not at all a starting point for me. It was really the research that Bruno did and told me, and the one that we did together, that it was like something new. And the thing about the boys who are kidnapped and trafficked, it was, I think it was a different kind of universe, world,
right.
Or, you know.
Yeah.
So it was a different thing.
Okay, so we'll be right back with Ana Moreira for more after this.
Fred.
We're back with Ana Moreira, who plays the lead role in the film Sombra. And that is what we've been talking about. Now, Ana, I asked this same question to Bruno earlier, and given the nature of this film, I'd like to ask you as well. So given the difficult themes dealt with in the film, from human trafficking to child kidnapping and so on, do you feel that a film like this can help actuate change in some way?
Yes, I think so. I mean, cinema can be, or fiction cinema can be a way for you to organize your reality and discuss and debate the themes or the questions that are that you are preoccupied with, you know? So if it's something that you want to dive in and you are interested to tell about, in an honest way, if you want to say that, I think that fiction film can help with that and can help people also,
To return to the actual working on this film, I spoke with Bruno, and he actually told me that it was made during the pandemic times. So it was kind of as if you were working in a bubble. He used that term, which I've been thinking about since then. And I thought to ask you then, do you think that also contributed or even helped in some way to the feeling that your character feels? I'm thinking of those scenes where you were immersed in water and it almost feels like you're in your own bubble too. Do you feel like that contributed to the finished product, if we can say the call it a product? It's a terrible term. The finished film.
The movie was shot at the end of 2019, so almost at the start of the pandemic times, and we shot in a city called Viana do Castelo. It's in the north of Portugal, a beautiful city, and we. Most of the crew and everybody is more or less from Lisbon or nearby. And we were all together in that city. The thing is, when you shoot away from your home, you concentrate only on the movie. You don't have to worry about your everyday life. So you live and breathe and think the movie. And yes, and you create a bubble. And yes, that helped a lot to work, to create the character. And at the same time, you feel locked in that bubble. So there's really no place to go. So I think that helped all of us during the shooting.
And also reflect that feeling of helplessness that your character feels?
Mm-hmm. I think so, yes.
And finally, actually, while we're on the topic, I wanted to ask you, because these have been challenging times for everybody, including for the arts and, of course, the film industry, how you have been handling these current times as an artist and as an actor. Have you been able to stay active and creative?
Well, more or less. It's been difficult for everybody. But we have hope, and I continued working, doing a theater. We have, as many theaters have, online transmission. So we continue to rehearse and to do the plays. I did some shootings, but you know, for the actors or the professionals that work in culture, it's been really, really tough because we don't have really no support from the Minister of Culture. Things are not well between the professional sector of the arts and the Minister of Culture. So it's been really tough because it was already a really fragile profession.
Yeah.
So, and now, it's even worse, but everybody is struggling and everybody is supporting one another, and let's see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. I just out of curiosity, you mentioned doing some live stream theater, and I've never actually been able to ask anybody, but it has been sort of an option that actors have worked within for this past while. But how do you find that experience? Because you don't have the audience response, but how do you feel working within this format?
It's really strange.
Yeah.
It's really strange because we rehearse at the theater, we tape, record at the theater, the plays, but we don't have the audience, and then you don't know anymore if this is theater, if this is cinema, what is this? So it's really strange, and we miss the audience a lot.
Right.
We do.
Do you feel like this is something that will continue to happen even after the pandemic times? Do you feel like it somehow represents the future?
I don't know. Theater is really different, and I believe that people enjoy going to the theater and see the live plays and the actors' live. So I don't think that something is going to change after, hopefully, that the pandemic ends. So I think when this is over or better, and the theaters are open again, that people are going to come again to the theater. Right. We are not going to lose that.
Yeah, and hopefully that'll be sooner than later.
Yes.
That these places get to reopen.
Yes.
Anna, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Fred Film Radio.
Fred Film Radio.
Cinephile, we have come to the recurring segment of the show I like to call Dictionary of Film. This is the part of the show where I choose one term that is somehow related to the cinematic art form, expand on it a bit, and talk about it. Today we have reached the letter G, and for this entry I have chosen to talk about genres. The simplest definition of this term is that film genres are categories that define a movie based on its narrative elements. They help viewers organize information so that they will easily make more sense of what they are about to watch. Each film is unique in types of stories they tell. Films belonging to a specific genre share common, predictable, or distinctive artistic and thematic elements, or iconography, narrative content, plot, and subject matter. For example, Westerns have horses and guns. One of the things that should be addressed is that a film genre is different from a film style. A film style is actually a recognizable group of conventions used by filmmakers to add visual appeal, meaning, or depth to their work. That is what differentiates, for example, a deadpan comedy, like those by Wes Anderson, that are more somber, to a slapstick comedy film like those by Mel Brooks that are more eccentric and gag-based. In other words, film styles can be applied to any genre. So just to clarify, examples of film genres include comedies, horror, action, sci-fi, and so on. However, more often than not, any given film, particularly in the modern era, is a hybrid. This means that it is a mixture of several genres in one. A film like Back to the Future is a sci-fi and a comedy and a drama, and it even has a romantic subplot. Back to the Future Part 3 has all of the above, but it's set in a Western landscape. The Rocky Horror Picture Show is a horror, sci-fi, comedy, musical, and so on. Not to mention that if you really want to get sophisticated, most films are actually sub-genres. For instance, Silence of the Lambs is a psychological thriller drama. All this, of course, makes specific identification of any film difficult and problematic, especially when we consider that as the years went by, many filmmakers revised common elements of any genre or subgenre. When that happens, that's when we get revisionist genres. For example, the Western originally featured cowboys as the heroes and the Indians, with a J, as the bad guys. But in the later decades, we have seen that categorization questions often in such films like Dances with Wolves, for example. In the historical drama, we have seen anything from a glorification of the KKK in D.W. Griffith's infamous Birth of a Nation, but of course such a portrayal is basically unthinkable today, and rightly so. Several theorists and scholars have dedicated their entire careers to writing about the specificity of any film genre and to highlighting several flaws in the easy categorization of movies. A modern topic that has been explored has been the correlation between genre and algorithms that basically dominate the ways in which people consume films and series today on SVOD platforms. Other things that should be discussed is how identification of any genre can be influenced by the different cultures of different people and different countries. So you can see that the more we think about genre, the more questions begin to form. But that was our little dictionary of film entry on any film genre. Hopefully this will be a starting point for you to think about when you watch your next films in the coming days. Join me next week as we continue our exploration of several film terms in alphabetical order on future episodes of the Big Fred Tuesday. But for now, stay tuned for more film conversation on this episode.
Fred.
We talked about genre in our Dictionary of Film segment, and certainly one of the types of films that often confuse everybody about whether it's a genre, a style, or a movement are film noirs. In 2017, I interviewed one of the biggest experts in the world today about film noirs, Eddie Muller, who is also the founder and director of the Film Noir Foundation. I interviewed him at Il Cinema Ritrovato in Bologna that year, and here is a clip of that interview.
Can you explain, describe to our listeners what film noir is?
Well, film noir, I call it, speaking like an American now, right?
Right.
It was Hollywood's only organic artistic movement. That's the fancy way of explaining it. To the average person, they would be mid-20th century crime movies, but made with an abundance of style. The cinematography is just gorgeous. You know it when you see it, you know. It's like, why does this movie look so different, right? Incredible shadows, beautiful camera work. A very, dare I say, European sensibility that came to Hollywood movies. But for whatever reason, that style was applied to crime movies. Mostly, although you do see it in some other films. There are a few westerns of the period that look like this, or war movies that look like this, but mostly it was crime films.
Right, so but it wasn't exclusive to crime films.
No, not really. I mean, I have to tell you, this is the thing, Matt. One of the reasons film noir remains so popular to this day is because people can debate what it is exactly. Right? There is no fixed definition, right? If I said to you right now, well, it's a genre of film, a lot of people would argue with me about that. Like, no, it's not. It's a style of filmmaking. And other people, perhaps like me, would say, no, it's more like an ethos. It's like, it's a way of looking at the world and films. You know, that's very jaundiced, it's very cynical, and you don't believe in the inherent goodness of people.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, so that's something I've discovered that's so fascinating about it, is that you can argue what it is, and that leads to a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of passion that people have for these movies for that very reason.
Right, and just to complete kind of this overview, would you care to mention a few names of directors and a few figures that were particularly important in film noir?
Well, there are a number of important directors. If I said to you, you know, if I don't understand film noir, what should I watch to understand it? How about that? I'd say the movie Double Indemnity. There's a movie Out of the Past with Robert Mitchum, Orson Welles' Touch of Evil, Robert Siadmak's The Killers. These are like the definitive examples of what film noir looks and feels like, and what the themes are. Right, doomed men. Right, they fall for a woman. They have to commit a crime to win the woman's, to win her over. Usually with money, right?
Yeah.
And then everything goes wrong. Everything goes wrong. That's the basic principle.
To listen to the full interview, check out fred.fm/UK. That's fred.fm/UK.
Fred Film Radio.
Joining me on the Big Fred Tuesday is the director of a new provocative documentary titled A Man and a Camera, screening at CPH Docs. From the Netherlands, it's director Guido Hendricks. Guido, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
So Guido, just briefly to introduce the film that we will be talking about. The premise is very simple, but intriguing and provocative. And it kind of finds you silently pointing a camera at a number of people and seeing how they react. And you especially do so standing at their doorway. So this is just a very simple introduction for our listeners who don't know the film yet, just so they will know what we will be talking about. But very simple. To start us off, my question to you is, where did that idea come from?
Yeah, it actually has quite a long history, you could say. It was just one day I started to randomly film people on the street in silence. And you can say I was looking for an adventure back then. It was about, let's say, 7-8 years ago in the streets of Belgium. I was still studying in film school back then. And I decided I had this material. I put it aside for a few years, and then I started to revisit it. And then I was somehow intrigued by, yeah, you could say, this the tension and strange drama that that existed in these encounters, and also a little bit the underlying power relationship between the one behind and the front of the lens. And this is something I like to explore a bit further. So from that point, I took the project on in a more serious manner.
But I seem to understand that, yes, the origins of this project was very spontaneous.
It was very spontaneous. It was during a week, and then every day you got like a little assignment to do, and then I don't know exactly what was the exact trigger that started me like doing this. And also back then it was a bit, in that sense you could say, problematic, because I was more stalking people on the street. I didn't really give them a chance to escape, and that's when I began conceptualizing the film. So years later, then I started to appear on people's doorstep. And this was like, it was a way to, on the one hand, limit, you could say, the arena, to have a consistent arena, and also to give them a possibility to escape. Because of course, when the door opens, they could close it immediately if they were not interested.
Did you think that you knew how they would react to the camera? Were you expecting anything in particular in their reaction?
No, from the very start, not really. Of course, when I started to extend on the project, and to I filmed in almost all places, or like all remote places in the Netherlands. I traveled through the whole country doing this. And then, of course, after a while, when you get more and more reactions, and you go to more, you meet more and more people in this disguise, you could say. Yeah, then you start to have some predictions, but from the very start, not really.
And just out of curiosity, you mentioned that you went to different places in the Netherlands, right, to film this documentary.
Yeah.
So, do you see this as specifically an observation on Dutch society, or do you see its scope more universal?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think to a certain extent it does say something about Dutch society, but then at the same time I have to admit it's not like this sociological aspect is not really something that that I focused on. So it's not that I very systematically filmed in this and this kind of neighborhood, you know, exactly from upper to lower class. I think both aspects are in the film. I went to all different like social class places in the Netherlands, but still, it does show it does say something about the society, but also I think like the whole concept is very simple in that sense, and you could do it anywhere in the world. It would be something I would be interested in, like what would happen if you would do this in North America or Africa or any place.
So you mentioned power relations in an earlier answer, and this exploration of power relations is something that I also noticed in your previous film, Stranger in Paradise, where newly arrived refugees learn lessons about the way Europe is, essentially. Do you find that the two films are correlated in that sense too?
I mean, yeah, regarding that manner, they are. I mean, I think I'm always interested in power relations, but I think this one is more explicitly focusing on the power relations between, you could say the one behind and in front of the camera lens. I think especially in documentary filmmaking, you could say there is some kind of inherent exploitative aspect if you, of course, portray people, and it's something, if you are become aware of it, you can, of course, make sure that you're not exploiting the people you portray, of course. But of course, there is, you have a certain power. It's also what I felt, I think, every time I went to people to film them in this way. I also had to persuade myself, because and it was not very easy to do, I have to say.
Yeah, I'd say so, yeah.
Yeah, I felt, yeah, like a certain necessity. And yeah, I did also feel this you could say exhilarating mixture between shame and power. So I felt powerful behind the camera when I didn't say a word, and they had to, like, in a certain way show themselves. And yeah.
And you're not a tyrant, so you didn't enjoy menacing people in that way.
No. It's not. No, I didn't enjoy it. But I did feel though this mixture between shame and power. And that I think that is also what increases the tension, because there's also certain resistance from my side. I think it's not necessarily bad, I think.
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like A Man and a Camera is a film where you kind of push the limit of where you could go, to the point where it almost becomes difficult or uncomfortable to watch. I think, you know, in your project, do you also consider or question maybe the role of spectators within a viewing experience too?
Very much, I think. I think for me, this is something that's like from the starting point of a basic idea until the last day in sound design and in the mix, I'm always thinking about, like, to what place will the spectator be moved. So not necessarily that I want to decide or manipulate him exactly to a certain place, or his imagination, you could better say, but I'm always thinking of, okay, what, yeah, like trying to be in the position of the spectator. So try to be a spectator myself and try to look at the film in this way, like what happens when I watch this and what questions does it raise? That's always something I'm thinking about.
And just to follow up on that, what are the films that you are most drawn to as a spectator?
Ooh, good question. Yeah, I think it's a very broad, like, I think from when I started to get interested in filmmaking, I think Michael Haneke was really one of the people that triggered me a lot. But yeah, Ray Gadas more recently, I think it's a filmmaker that I think makes amazing things. But also, of course, all the work of people, Fellini, etc. Ruben Östlund also.
Right.
Yeah.
And after that eclectic list of filmmakers, we're going to take a short break. And we will be back for more with Guido Hendricks to talk more about his latest documentary, A Man and a Camera. So stick around.
Fred Film Radio.
We're back with Guido Hendricks, director of A Man and a Camera, screening at CBH Docs. And Guido, considering the nature of your documentary and how unexpected some of the reactions you got from the people you were filming were, how would you explain the impact of your camera and the reactions it garnered from the people you were filming?
Yeah, it's again a good question. I would say, of course, the camera, it plays a role. It plays a big part. And it's, you know, that's also when I would also, you know, when you would ask me to define the film in one sentence, I would say that it explores ways in which we can relate to a video camera, but also to the unknown. And when I say the unknown, that more relates, I think, to me as a person, like a complete stranger, someone you don't know. You don't know what he's going to do. Like the unexpected, and it's hard to distinguish. It's one entity in that sense in the film.
I was thinking as well specifically that it probably wouldn't have happened if you just walked in with your iPhone or something, just filming the people. But the fact that your camera does seem professional, from what I could tell, maybe legitimized you in a sense.
It's true. I think a certain amount of people would exactly think like you describe it in this way. Okay, it's a professional, you know, it's someone who I can probably trust to a certain extent because he has a professional camera. But it can also be very like too intriguing or you know, too oppressing, this camera. And maybe others would say, oh, an iPhone is maybe a bit more low key. I don't know. It could maybe go either way, but.
Are you concerned about things like surveillance? I mean, after all, surveillance has been a big part of human rights discourse for quite some time now, especially recently.
Yeah, I think it's something that we should be really aware of, and it's not, I mean, I don't know exactly the English word, but in the Netherlands we say it seems like a fight that's almost already been fought, you know, like there are people standing up against it. It's something that should be done a lot more, because it's like if you like this in terms of privacy and these things, it's I think it's not a good development, I would say.
So you are definitely not on the side that thinks that it would improve people's security. They would have to let go of too much of their freedom.
No, yeah, exactly. I think that's just the security argument. It's for me, it's like the idea of security. Yeah, I would say, but no real security. That's what I think.
And yeah, and it's interesting how cameras, what role they have in society in general, right? Because right now I'm looking at, I'm sitting in front of my laptop and I got a camera on it, and I don't know whether someone is looking at me.
Yeah,
probably not, because I'm not that different, but I'm not that interesting. I don't claim to be that interesting that I can be spied on. I've got nothing in particular to hide. But then also, you know, when I'd be walking down the street and maybe someone is filming me or something, cameras have become so accessible to the point where now they're just play a very important role in the social fabric, you know, in the structure of our very lives, don't you think?
Yeah, it's very true. I think there's a certain, you could say, over familiarity of cameras. And that's, I think maybe that did play a part in this film, that I did try to go to places where that over familiarity of cameras was less present. So a little bit the more remote places where maybe it's a bit more spontaneous how the people relate to a camera there. I remember in the film there's also one scene of a young boy who just, it seems like it's the first time he sees a camera in his life. And when his mother comes, she's also in the house, and then she shows her face just for 2 seconds, and she's really, what is happening here, you know?
That is amazing. That is an amazing scene. It almost feels like a meeting of worlds.
Exactly.
It feels like he's looking at E.T.
Yeah. Maybe that's,
It's completely speechless, but smiling in wonder. It's like he's asking himself, what is this? You know, but not frightened, almost fascinated.
No. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's also why I liked it. It's the complete fascination and curiosity that's still present.
In my introduction, I actually mentioned the word provocation. Do you agree with the term? I mean, I guess people will be, people watching it may refer to the film once they've seen it as a provocation.
I mean, I don't know if it's important if I agree. I mean, I don't have a problem if people would see this as a provocation. I mean, especially as a starting point, I think provocation in film is never it's a bad thing or not necessarily in any case. But of course, if it just stays with a provocation, then I think the film, has failed, I would say. So I hope that maybe starting from a provocation, there is more to it. That's of course to others to judge. But I think when the film develops, that at a certain point the provocation is replaced by different questions, I would say, in different themes.
And do you think that this film may lead people to have discussions about specific things? Do you expect it to have that type of resonance?
Probably, yeah. Like this, what you just mentioned, the presence of cameras and surveillance in society, probably it could open a discussion about it. But at the same time, yeah, for me, well, I think I didn't mention yet, but it was also to a certain extent, this film, I would say, a way to subvert this contemporary documentary formula, which is something I should maybe elaborate on a little bit, because
sure, yeah.
Like, in my opinion, the vast majority of documentaries these days are, yeah, exploring or, in a bad case, exploiting extraordinary subjects, like be there famous singers, oppressed minorities. You know, it's always about the extraordinary, or most of the times. And with this film, I try to turn this a little bit around and to focus on ordinary people, like your neighbor, in that sense, that you wouldn't necessarily think of to make a film about. And I try to switch the, or to move the extraordinary aspect to the form or to the approach. So instead of a extraordinary or a ordinary film about extraordinary people, I try to think to make an extraordinary film about ordinary people.
And playing with the form at the same time, because this is quite different from the traditional type of documentary filmmaking in the way that it has evolved and in the way in which it's prominent today, right?
Yeah, I hope so. But there was something, one of the reasons that I wanted to go on with this when I revisited the material, because I thought it had this this potential, maybe.
Right, yeah. Do you think we live in a golden age of documentary? I've been hearing that so much lately that I've never actually asked anybody, but I kind of just felt like ending our interview with that.
Golden age, yeah, it's golden age. I mean, in terms of quantity, I would say yes. In terms of quality, I don't know. I have to think about it.
Does it reach the standards of the 60s and 70s direct cinema, you know?
Yeah, I mean, of course, the good thing is it's, you know, you could say it's much more democratic, and that's what I like. Everyone can take a camera or start to make a documentary, but at the same time, I think this counts for every business, I would say, but the amount of documentaries being produced these days, it's like a sublime experience. Like, it's completely overwhelming you. No one can even, you know, grasp or try to categorize them, because it's just too much, I would say. So that's something I would support. Like, let's like think before we unleash something into the open. Like, what does it add to the existing flow flood, you could say, of documentaries?
Yeah. All right, Guido, thanks very much for joining us and talking with us today. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
Fred.
Cinephile, we have come to the end of yet another episode of the Big Fred Tuesday, Fred Film Radio's weekly show on all things cinema, with a particular focus on independent filmmaking and the international film festival scene. But as usual, I will end it with an alternate cinema recommendation for our regular popcorn classics segment. Hopefully this is part of a slew of titles that I have mentioned over the course of these shows that is helping you further your explorations on cinema and help you earn that coveted black belt in cinephilia. The film that I will talk about today is a bit of a cult classic in American cinema that I absolutely adore, and you should too. It's called A New Leaf, and it's a 1971 black comedy that was directed by Elaine May, who also stars in the film, alongside the beloved American actor Walter Matthau. The story of this film revolves around an incredibly wealthy man who finds out he has lost all his money. So he comes up with this plan to get it all back by, as the great Eric von Stroheim would put it in one of his iconic films about the decadent upper class, is marry rich. But that's not all, as he decides that it wouldn't be enough to marry a wealthy woman, and that it would be even better to murder her. No, this is not a Hitchcockian thriller, although the Hitchcockian influences are felt all throughout the movie. Elaine May had actually come across a Jack Ritchie short story that she would adapt into A New Leaf in the pages of an Alfred Hitchcock mystery magazine. She upped the black comedy aspect of the story, and I have no doubt that Hitchcock himself would have appreciated its sense of humor, though there's no way for us to know whether he actually ever watched it. Inevitably, the film also draws comparisons with Kind Hearts and Coronets, the iconic 1949 British film that I also take this opportunity to recommend to you if you have not seen it yet. But in the end, A New Leaf allows for unlikely space for charm and romanticism, and even risks making what I feel is one of the most convincing arguments for monogamy that I have ever seen in a motion picture. Several moments of the film feel absolutely original to me, and there is real vision behind this movie that sets it apart from other contemporaries of its time. While she was never able to replicate the critical success of A New Leaf, Elaine May continued to work in Hollywood, and a lot with her former comic partner, Mike Nichols, including on the 1996 adaptation of La Cage aux Folies, reimagined as The Birdcage. She also received an Oscar nomination for her screenplay work on Heaven Can Wait from 1978 and Primary Colors from 1998. And I feel like I should emphasize that Walter Matthau in the role of the obnoxious, selfish lead character is at a career best. I give A New Leaf 5 bags of popcorn, 5 cups of soda, and 0 carbon in the valves. And that does it for me this week. Don't forget to tune in next week for more cinematic goodness and a brand new episode of the Big Fred Tuesday. I remind you that there is plenty of content for you to sink your ears into on Fred.fm and in multiple languages as well. So check that stuff out. That's all for me. Stay healthy, stay safe, stay strong, stay cinephile, and stay tuned to Fred Film Radio, the festival insider.
Fred Film Radio, I'm Matt McCucci from the 64th Berlin International Film Festival.
Io sono Valentina Pompili al Tokyo International Film Festival.
Soy Antonio Becker y estoy aquí con...
Internationalen Filmfestspielen in Berlin. Mein Name ist Beatrice Beden.
Herren Begumfi, Fred Film Radio.
Fred, the festival experience in 23 languages.
Fred Film Radio.
24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.